floodwaters are expected to stay where they are for at least another 10 days. And the fact that rain is forecast in the next few days in the mountains above Porto Alegre isn't going to help the situation at all.
And that's all in today's international news from non-NATO media. For KPFK's Rebel Alliance News, I'm Paulina Vasilyev.
And you've been listening again to KPFK Rebel Alliance News. We're in the middle of our fund drive, so please make a donation. Call 818-985-5735 right now. Rebel Alliance News thanks our engineer, Wendell Handy, contributors like Polina Vasilyev, Don DeBar, and our producer, Ziri Rideau. Coming up next is Feminist Magazine. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back tomorrow at 6 p.m., and I'll be back with you next Wednesday at 6 p.m., and I hope you will join us again. For KPFK, I'm West Siegmiller.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse collective of feminists. And every week we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today. And this is what feminism can sound like.
I'm Amy Gastelum. You're listening to Making Contact. This week, we're following up on a story about self-managed abortion that we produced last spring. A lot has changed since then, and we're here to catch you up. That said, post-Roe abortion care access is changing daily in the U.S. right now. This story is being produced for broadcast in April 2024. Things may have changed by the time you hear it.
After the Arizona Supreme Court upheld a Civil War-era abortion ban on Tuesday, Democrats in the state legislature tried to open debate on a bill that would repeal the 1864 law, but they were blocked by Republicans, who cut them off and quickly adjourned for the week. It led to this chaotic scene on the state house floor.
All in favor of that motion, vote aye.
Aye.
All opposed, vote no. Ayes have it, so ordered.
Arizona recently joined several other states severely restricting abortion care, mostly in the South and Midwest. Since the Supreme Court's Dobbs decision overturned Roe v. Wade in June 2022, access to legal abortion care has varied widely depending on the region of the country. Some states, like California, have protected legal access to abortion care by making it part of their state constitution. Other states, like Indiana, where I live, have created bans so restrictive it's almost impossible to qualify for a legal abortion here. But networks for helping people find abortion care are robust and, in many ways, growing.
Hi, this is Jess from All Options and the Hoosier Fund.
You may remember Jessica Marchbank from the story on self-managed abortion we published last year. She's the state programs director at All Options Pregnancy Resource Center in Bloomington, Indiana. In this recording from 2023, she's in her office on the phone, following up with someone who needed funds for her abortion care.
Oh, good. Are you all set? You don't need any additional financial assistance? Okay. Oh, that's fantastic. I'm really, really happy to hear that. If anything changes, don't hesitate to get in touch and we'll be here, okay?
At the time, Jess would often refer callers like this to clinics in Indiana for care, but not anymore. Indiana's abortion ban went into effect in August 2023. There are a few narrow exemptions, but the law is so restrictive that abortion clinics like Planned Parenthood and Whole Woman's Health aren't providing abortion care in Indiana at all. I am curious, you know, in terms of the logistics. I mean, since August 2023, like, how has that affected your work? What's changed?
I mean, in some ways, it's really simple and very little has changed. And of course, in other ways, everything has changed because now the vast majority of people are not going to be able to access an abortion within the state they live in.
It's a huge blow, but it wasn't a walk in the park before the ban went into effect.
So, leading up to the ban taking effect in Indiana, access to abortion care in-state had gotten pretty bad.
Rules like gestational age limits, mandatory counseling, and laws aimed at restricting how clinics operate already made it hard to get an abortion in Indiana. The Hoosier Abortion Access Study showed that even before the ban, about 1 in 4 Hoosiers who needed an abortion were already traveling out of state for care. Now it's even worse in Indiana. I'll just say that I looked at Abortion Finder, you know, to see like, okay, if I'm 6 weeks pregnant, you know, where do I need to go? Like, how can I do this? And it was such a fascinating journey to be like, okay, well, the closest clinic to me is in Cincinnati, but
you'll have to go there twice.
You have to go there twice. Yeah. I can't be a minor. But if I go to Champaign, everything changes. If I go west to Illinois, I can be a minor and I don't have to do the counseling.
Right.
And it's up to, I think, 24 weeks gestation, whereas in Ohio, it's 22.
Right.
So it was like, wow. I mean, east or west makes a huge difference.
Oh, it definitely does. A lot of our callers are from the Indianapolis area. So right off the top of my head, if they say they're going to Dayton, we always, clinic choice is always up to the individual, but we want to make sure that they have all of the information. So it's almost, depending on where they are in Indianapolis, it could be almost the same distance between them and Dayton and them and Champaign. Sometimes they'll say, well, you know, Champaign's 5 miles farther away. And I'll say, but you only have to go there once. and that really does make a huge difference to a lot of folks. Sometimes they'll choose to go even further and go up to Chicago because there are numerous clinics in Chicago, and sometimes it's easier to get a fast appointment up that way, even if it means they're driving farther.
This running around to find abortion health care is more than many people can do. In-clinic abortion care costs a lot, around $600, and often requires time off from work. Childcare and transportation are also major barriers for some. Forcing people to travel further for care means some folks just aren't going to get it. And as Jess said, these barriers have existed long before the Dobbs decision in 2022.
Yes, Roe gave us the legal protection to get an abortion, to have an abortion. But, you know, so many people did not have real access to abortion, right?
Dr. Melissa Madeira is a researcher and consultant on lots of projects related to abortion access. She says people who have the hardest time getting care are those who live far from a city, are marginalized by gender identity, race, or immigration status.
And many people, many people do not have the financial ability to access abortion. So we have to really think about that. Yes, Roe gave us legal access to abortion, but it didn't actually give us all access to abortion all the time whenever we needed it. I think what's really important to think about is that we need multiple avenues to abortion care. Not one way is the right way for everyone, right? And even in states where abortion is still accessible, and I hate using the word legal or, you know, talking about legalities because I don't want to give the law any real legitimacy because it's not legitimate. Like this is not legitimate, right? And so we need various ways, various avenues for people to access abortion. And we should start thinking about how do we construct that for the day in which everyone in every state will be able to access abortion or have legal access to abortion. Again, using the word legal.
The problem of legal abortion care access is old. It's older than Dobbs. It's older than Roe. But self-managed abortion is also old. People have been managing their own abortions for thousands of years using herbs, teas, and other methods passed down from families and cultural traditions. These days, self-managed abortion is usually done using the same medications that doctors use for abortions, mifepristone and misoprostol. In 2022, the World Health Organization stated outright that it's safe for a person to manage their own first trimester abortion without a clinician's help. Whether you get these pills in person from a doctor or order them online, the effect is the same. Here's how it works.
There are two types of abortion available, surgical and medical. In this video, we will focus on medical abortion. Medical abortion, often referred to as the abortion pill, is a safe and effective way of ending a pregnancy. The pill is usually taken within the first 12 weeks of gestation. The whole process can take up to 2 weeks to complete, although most women feel normal again after just 2 days. Depending on the method, it can be up to 98% effective. How does it work? Medical abortion can consist of two types of medication, mifepristone and misoprostol. Using a combination of both is the most effective method. Mifepristone works by blocking progesterone, a hormone necessary to maintain a pregnancy, while misoprostol works by causing the uterus to contract and empty. The combination method requires one mifepristone pill followed by four misoprostol pills 24 to 48 hours later. If mifepristone is not available, misoprostol can be taken on its own. This method is slightly less effective. When taking misoprostol alone, 12 pills are to be taken within a 12-hour period. Four every 3 hours is the recommended procedure to follow. What can you expect from a medical abortion? Misoprostol causes cramping and bleeding to empty the uterus. It can feel like a heavy period, and it's not uncommon to pass large blood clots during the process. Side effects can include diarrhea and vomiting, tiredness, mild fever or chills, headaches, and dizziness. To ease pain and discomfort, some of the following may help. Staying at home or in a comfortable space when taking the pills, taking ibuprofen or painkillers before the procedure, having a hot bath or shower, ensuring a friend or family member present to help reassure and comfort you, having an emergency plan in place for any potential complications. Urgent medical advice will need to be sought if you experience excess heavy bleeding, if more than two pads are filled per hour for 2 hours, intense pain, continuous vomiting, a fever of higher than 38 degrees Celsius that persists for longer than 12 hours. What happens next? This will depend on each woman's individual experience. Most women can expect tiredness, cramping, and bleeding for a few days. Within 24 to 48 hours, most women feel fine to return to their daily routine. Although it is not essential, it is advisable to plan a follow-up appointment with a health provider 2 weeks after the procedure. They can confirm if the process was successful and discuss your contraceptive options. What happens to periods? Periods should return to normal 4 to 6 weeks after taking the pills. If it does not return, a pregnancy test should be taken to confirm there are no longer signs of a pregnancy. How soon can sex be resumed? Sex can be resumed as soon as you feel ready. Pregnancy can happen soon after medical abortion, so it is advisable to talk with a health provider about the right contraception for you. To find out more information on the options available in your nearest clinic, please visit www.ippf.org. You can also visit www.womenonweb.org for further information on medical abortion.
While traditional in-clinic access to abortion care is increasingly difficult across the U.S., activists around the country are working to get people the care they need, especially in the form of pills. One online hub is plancpills.org. Here's Dr. Melissa Madera again. She's helped the organization with some research projects.
2015, that's when Plan C was founded. Yeah, so it's been a long time. I mean, before the access issues got the worst, which is right now. 7 years ago, they were right? We're in 2023 now. They were thinking, the co-founders were thinking, like, how can we let people know more about how to get abortion pills online? Because people have been doing this and using abortion pills on their own, self-managing in other countries for many, many years. So the thought was, oh, this is something that's happening globally. People in the U.S. should also know about it, because we all know that even though we had the right to an abortion, many people didn't have access to abortion. So the question is, how can we get more access to people? And abortion pills is one of those ways. So yeah, it's been a long time that this team has been working on making sure that people know how to access abortion pills online and to manage their abortion safely. And it's the most comprehensive guide to abortion pills on the interwebs. So you can go online and search very specifically for your state. They give you information on where to get pills, how to order them, and then resources around if you have questions about the medical aspects of things while you're self-managing, if you have questions about the legal aspects of things, also resources for those.
Here in Indiana, if I go to plancpills.org, I can order pills online from Aid Access, Abuzz, and Cambridge Reproductive Health Consultants. If I choose one of these, I would receive virtual support from a clinician if I need it, and it costs around $150. No travel necessary. But there are also 25 other sites listed. Some provide abortion pills for as little as $0. That's right, free 99. Those sites do not offer clinician support, but plancpills.org also links out to the miscarriage and abortion hotline, a phone and text hotline staffed by abortion care providers. Here's Dr. Marrera again.
And for some people, like, they want to use these pills and they are like, oh, I know it's safe and I can do this on my own. Some people are like, well, I don't really want to do that. And you know what? It also has to do with your circumstances, right? Because if you are someone who can't take days off of work, or feel like, you know, I really have to like be home with my kids, you might want to go to a clinic, get a procedure and go back home and it's done, right? And so one of the most important things to me is like, we need to trust people, right? To make the right decision that is good for them based on their own circumstances, right? So people are going to make their decisions based on like, how much money I have, where I live, can I take time off of work? I have kids. You know, it's like there's so many ways in which people have to like come to this decision on their own. And we need to respect that and give them all the options so they can do the right thing for them.
Self-managed abortion isn't for everyone, but plancpills.org fills a gap, improves a movement. It shows that folks are still working hard to get abortion care to people who need it. Other sites like the Repro Legal Helpline and abortionfinder.org also help people navigate this confusing time. But none of these sites can replace what local abortion funds do in terms of boots on the ground. Local orgs know the laws in their states. They create networks between each other to get their people's needs met. They even advocate at the local legislative level. After the Dobbs decision, All Options was part of the group that sued the state of Indiana over an abortion ban. That action led to an injunction that lasted until August 2023. That meant abortion care could continue for about a year. It gave networks a chance to plan how to operate after the ban would go into effect. Here's Jess from All Options in Bloomington again.
So if we back up 2 years in time, let's go back to that, shall we?
Do-do-do-do-do-do-do.
2 years ago, right. Well, it still wasn't a walk in the park, but 2 years ago, we as the All Options Hoosier Abortion Fund, I think we had working relationships with maybe 20 different abortion care providers, mostly in Indiana, and then a few in like Illinois, Ohio, Michigan, and then like the DuPont Clinic and a clinic in Colorado. And we were in partnership with other regional abortion funds, but not, it was more allyship, but we didn't really work closely together. So between the Dobbs ruling and until our ban took effect, we really just doubled down on making sure that we were really well connected to everyone we needed to be connected to. So we now have working relationships with over 60 abortion care providers in 9 different states.
Wow.
So I believe we're working with every single clinic in Illinois, most in Michigan, most in Ohio. And the majority of Hoosiers really are going to Illinois at this point, but plenty still go to Ohio and Michigan. We're really fortunate to really build those relationships with the other abortion funds. And my heart just feels really full when I think about how we can lean on each other. The Chicago Abortion Fund, Kentucky Health Justice Network, Abortion Fund of Ohio, and Midwest Access Coalition. We have like private signal groups with all of the different funds. We have ways to reach out directly to say, hey, we're supporting this caller who needs extensive support. We can do this much. Can you do the rest?
Meaning funding.
Funding and practical support, childcare, meals, rides, hotels, mm-hmm. things like that.
So there are volunteers helping with these kinds of things, or is it like more funding?
Sometimes volunteers, sometimes it's cash assistance or a gas card.
Okay.
A Lyft or Uber. Depends on the region and whatever fund is working with them. We are still, because we are small, we are focused on abortion funding, procedural funding. We don't really have the capacity to do more like cash assistance right now. But even so, for years and years, the Chicago Abortion Fund and Midwest Access Coalition have already been covering Indiana with that type of support,
yeah.
and doing it well. You know, they have the infrastructure already. And I appreciate them so much because going into this year, we knew that we wouldn't be able to sustain the level of funding that we had through, like, from mid-2022 until really until the ban took effect in August of 23.
Mm-hmm.
We were flooded with unprecedented levels of donations. That's what allowed us to go from funding 30 people a month to for a couple of months, hundreds of people in a month.
Mm-hmm.
It was because we had more money. Those donations have dwindled. People have stopped rage giving. I think a lot of Americans think, oh, the crisis is over. Like, what more really can be done? Which is like, no, the crisis is not over. And in fact, in some ways, it's really just getting going.
I'm Salima Hamrani. You're listening to Making Contact and a story about self-managed abortion in the United States. If you like today's show and want more information, or if you'd like to leave us a comment, visit us at radioproject.org, where you can access today's show and all of our prior episodes. And now, back to the show with Amy Castellan.
We will hear argument this morning in case 23-235, the Food and Drug Administration versus Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine and the consolidated case. General Prilliger.
In March, the Supreme Court heard opening arguments in a case that could make it illegal for anyone to use mifepristone for abortion care, including providers in states where abortion is legal. Remember, mifepristone blocks the hormone progesterone, essentially ending a pregnancy. Misoprostol causes cramping that empties the uterus. It is possible to use misoprostol alone for an abortion, but it's more effective to use both drugs.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. FDA approved mifepristone based on the agency's scientific judgment that the drug is safe and effective. It's maintained that judgment across five presidential administrations, and millions of Americans have used mifepristone to safely end their pregnancies. Respondents may not agree with that choice, but that doesn't give them Article III standing or a legal basis to upend the regulatory scheme.
If the Food and Drug Administration loses this case, abortion care for everyone will change dramatically. More than half of all abortions performed in the U.S. are done using mifepristone and misoprostol. Meanwhile, local abortion funds are working this issue from all angles, leaning on one another. They're advocating at legislative levels. All Options has sued the state. Again, they're trying to expand the exemptions for legal abortion in Indiana. They're also coming up with creative ways to get people sexual health care. This month, All Options teamed up with the Midwest Action Coalition and Indiana Task Force to install an emergency contraception vending machine. It's located at the rear of a general store called Dear Mom on Indianapolis's Near East Side, a neighborhood where one in every four people lives in poverty. Besides emergency contraception, the hand-painted machine holds all kinds of sexual health supplies, condoms, dental dams, and pregnancy tests.
My grandmother is from Kentucky.
The shop hosted a launch party for it. In one video posted to social media, a group of about 25 gathers in the store.
Your new best friend.
And as they chat, a woman in a red t-shirt pushes a button on the vending machine while her friend records. A small green Plan B box drops. The woman reaches through the door flap, pulls out the box, and poses, smiling for her friend. Projects like this are hyper-local, and Jess says continuing to support local abortion funds is more important than ever.
Someone who is a strong supporter of All Options and has been for years as a donor and supporter and advocate messaged me on Facebook, I think, when it was announced that the ban was going to take effect. And she was basically like, hey, do you have any recommendations on where I should donate my money now since you won't be able to do anything? And I was like, wait. The only thing that has changed is that we're generally not helping people access abortions in Indiana.
In Indiana. You're referring them out.
Yeah. There's nothing that prevents us from paying for a Hoosier to get an abortion in any of the legal states.
What do you think that people can be doing to help folks get access to abortion or to advocate for it in a red state like Indiana or in a state like Mississippi?
There are things people can do. I do think generally if people are able to donate dollars, donating to grassroots organizations who are actively working in advocacy and access is really important. Like specifically within Indiana, donating to someone like All Options, it makes a real impact. Like, I get a $50 donation from a local person, and I can imagine a larger organization being like, oh, $50. I'm like, oh, $50. I can buy 2 cases of diapers. You know, like, I know exactly where that money is going to go to, and I can picture the family that it's going to go to, or, you know, to abortion funding, which is sort of this never-ending stream of need. People will continue to get pregnant and not want to be so. And so really donating to any organization that is in the fight for access and making abortion more accessible to all people is something I'll always advocate for. Likewise, donating time to any of organizations like All Options, Keep Our Clinics, even I Need an A. I think they have some different volunteer opportunities, and those sites are vital in helping people access care.
All right. What else should people know about abortion access right now in Indiana?
I think the refrain that I've been sort of broadcasting for the last 18 months is, first, don't give up hope. You can get an abortion. It's not just us. There are teams of people who are here to help people get the care they need and deserve, whatever that is. So I don't want people to feel like that sense of confusion, disinformation, and misinformation. Don't let that keep you from exercising your rights and your choices and your agency as a human being. But it's also okay to be angry and to say, this is not okay. And I want my lawmakers to know this. I want my lawmakers to know that they acted specifically against the desires of the people of Indiana mm-hmm. when they enacted this ban. And I think people need to continue to vote and to contact their legislators to express how they feel about this. To say that the state of Indiana is actively repressing people's ability to fully live lives. And that goes for people who are having abortions or need abortions, and for people who are parents, which, you know, there's a big intersection there. We live in a state that is making it too difficult, too costly, too emotionally costly to fully embody our lives and to raise families. And that's not okay. And our lawmakers need to know that. So hope, but also rage.
Well, thank you so much for your time today, Jessica. And I'm going to try to keep it moving.
Keep it moving. That's what we got to do.
I'm Amy Gastelum. If you learned something in this episode today, I'm going to ask that you pass it on.
You're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara County, and streaming across the globe at kpfk.org, Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin. And coming up next...
There's something healing about being able to go back into African histories and see what we are capable of.
Afrofuturism is a genre movement rooting elements of science fiction and fantasy in traditions from Africa and the diaspora. And its popularity as a form of resistance is on the rise. But Afrofuturist concepts have been prevalent in music and literature since the 1950s. You've got jazz musician Sun Ra and authors Samuel R. Delaney and Octavia Butler.
The surrealists believed that you have to first change your dreams in order to change the world. And I feel that that's what speculative fiction, any kind of speculative fiction, people writing, black comics, they're imagining a better world. They're dreaming a better world, a different world. And I realized that's what I wanted to spend my life doing.
On this episode, authors Nalo Hopkinson, Nnedi Okorafor, and Jewel Gomez sit down with John Jennings at the San Francisco Public Library as part of the 2016 Black Comics Festival. They discuss the role of Afrofuturist thought in the modern context and the importance of allowing ourselves to imagine. I'm your guest host, Charlotte Landis, and you're listening to Making Contact.
When I sit down to write, I don't think I'm an Afrofuturist writer. I'm going to write an Afrofuturist whatever.
Nalo Hopkinson.
I'll happily claim the adjective. It happened after I started writing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It is a label that people use to try and pull together a pattern that they're seeing. And in so much as what it is, it's useful. But... It is also not as simple as I'm just a writer. Of course, I'm not just a writer. I am everything that I am. But the Afrofuturism part is, it's got to be somewhere else when I write, or it will stop me. I'm writing science fiction fantasy, so there's a lot of research that goes into it, and a lot of, not just research, but theorizing, because, of course, the history books leave stuff out. So you have to imagine yourself into those places. I'm researching the future, I'm researching the past, I'm researching black history, Caribbean history, white history. I barely stayed awake through a history class when I was in school. And now, if you look at my shelves, that stuff is all over the place. And I discover the more I go into it, the more I realize that human beings are human beings. You can reach back into the very beginning of time when human beings are human beings, and we aren't that different. And there's something healing about being able to go back into African histories and African cultures and African ways of life and see that what we are capable of, which, you know, but to see it proven over and over and over and over again as the centuries go by and the centuries go forward.
I definitely look into my past.
Nnedi Okorafor.
I am what I consider Niger-American, which means Niger is slang for Nigerian, and I'm American. So Nigerian-American. I was born and raised in this country, but from a young age, my parents were taking me back to, my siblings and I, back to Nigeria to reconnect with our heritage, reconnect with our family. Most of our family is there. And then also just being Nigerian American in the house, within that culture, within the Igbo culture, those old traditions and ways have seeped into who I am as well. So those all manifest themselves. My Nigerian Americanness definitely manifests itself in my work. I deal a lot with the the traditional spiritualities, especially of the Igbo people, but of other parts of the continent as well. One example are masquerades. Masquerades show up in my works a lot. Masquerades are found in many different African cultures, but I have like a lot of what I write about comes from personal experience. So my personal experience with masquerades. Masquerades are like they are manifestations of the dead and the ancestors and spirits. And they are many different types. Some can look very monstrous, like, you know, just raffia in cloth that they can look like monsters. And those are the ones that I've been obsessed with. And so when I was a kid, whenever we'd go back to Nigeria, the masquerades would come out around Christmas time, that's a whole other issue. You come out around Christmas time, and because my sisters and I were American Nigerians, they would harass us the most. So, and they would literally chase us down the street. Okay, they would chase us. They had like a whip, and they would whip people, and they would chase us down the street with the whip. And luckily, we were fast, so we weren't caught too many times. So when I think back, I'm like, okay. And a lot of times we would outrun them. And so when I think back, I'm like, oh, I was outrunning the spirits. And so in my own stories, you see the masquerade show up a lot in my stories, and they show up in a way where they show up in the way that I imagine them, because I've seen the really big, terrifying ones at weddings, and all the women just run to the other side of the room. It's just, it's really quite epic. And in my stories, because I'm writing speculative fiction, I can imagine those masquerades the way I see them, which is as they're not people or men in particular dressed up in these elaborate costumes who then take on the ancestor or the spirit. They are that creature. Mm. And so in my stories, I can do that. I can show them that way. And I have a lot of fun with it. So I do look in the past.
I would love to hear if people have specifics about what prompted them to write their first.
Jewel Gomez.
Mine was based on a very specific incident that happened to me in the mid-80s. Does anybody here remember telephone booths? Okay. I was in a telephone booth at the corner of my street. I guess my phone wasn't working or I had rebelled and not paid the bill. But so I was in the phone booth, and these two guys walked by me and went into their whole thing. Oh, baby, let me suck your blah, 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 and I want to do this to you, and oh, you're looking so good, as if that would interest me, their opinion. And I was talking to my friend, Marianne, and she said, what's going on? I said, hold on a second. I turned and looked at them, and I said, please go away. And then I turned back to Marianne. Well, of course, they didn't go away. They just went on and on. I said, hold on. I turned around. I said, motherfucker, I will kill you if you don't get a with me. And one of the guys said, this is crazy. And the other guy was just like, kept on going. I said, yes, I am crazy, and I will kill you. And used a lot of that language that my grandmother had asked me not to use. And the one guy dragged the other guy away. And this was on West End Avenue and 93rd Street in Manhattan. My adrenaline had gone through my body like crazy. I was so happy there was nothing at hand for me to pick up.
Right.
Because they keep West End Avenue kind of clean. So my friend, Marianne, I heard her screaming, Jewel, 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 because she thought I was killing someone. And so I said, Marianne, I can't talk. I have to go home. I can't talk. So I went home, and I caught my breath, and I sat down, and I wrote the first Gilda story. Mm. Wow. And it was a woman walking in on the street, and a guy does that to her, and of course she kills him.
I'm so going to use that when I teach the Gilda stories.
Tosses his body in the river. So I decided I better use my powers for good.
Please.
And over time, you know, evolved the vampire mythology, because that's really what I realized I was working on, so that she didn't have to kill people, and developed the whole philosophy around it. So that fit into my political, mm-hmm. social political philosophy, mm-hmm. as a lesbian feminist. And I felt like You know, the surrealists believed that you have to first change your dreams in order to change the world.
Right.
And I feel that that's what speculative fiction, any kind of speculative fiction, people writing black comics, they're imagining a better world. They're dreaming a better world, a different world. And I realized that's what I wanted to spend my life doing as opposed to, you know, killing people on the street.
I keep going back to Walter Mosley, who you may or may not know, has written science fiction novels and short stories.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Yeah. All right.
And I'm going to paraphrase him, but he basically said we need a better world, and in order to have a better world, in order to make it, we first need to be able to imagine it.
Mm-hmm.
And also Samuel R. Delaney, mentor of mine, who said, we need visions of the future, and our people need them more than most.
Mm-hmm.
So,
that's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
It was true then, true now. And so there is very much a connection. And I sort of also think, yeah, the work is there. The work needs to be done. It's desperate. But we also need to be able to enjoy, to have fun, to have imagination, to have passion, because why else are we doing this? So I think we also need to give ourselves permission to enjoy. The work is there and we will do it. So there's very much a connection between allowing ourselves to imagine, allowing ourselves to think that we get to, like anybody else, have fun, and using that to fuel the vision of what it is we're trying to make. Sometimes I just want to write strange stories set in strange places. My own reality will always seep into those stories. But I want to hold on to the fact that we get to do all of it.
Right.
Yeah, I'm sitting here thinking about the word using these narratives for social justice, and I'm very resistant to that.
Yeah.
Because I know that when I sit down and to write something, I'm not thinking that, okay, I want to make this point. You know, this is something I want to show the world about whatever. When it comes down to it, when I sit down to write, I'm not thinking about anything. I'm just letting it flow. I'm a very subconscious writer where oftentimes I don't even have an outline. I don't even know who the character is. I'll just sit down and just start. And whatever is flowing through me is what will flow through me. So the idea of using the narrative for something is foreign to me. I mean, I understand other writers, other artists who operate like that, but for me, I definitely don't. But I do know that I'm very much a political person. So those ideas and my what I want to see, the changes that I want to see and the things that I want to do and want to see done, those are already there. Those are things that I might have conversations about when I'm not writing. But when I sit down to write, those things come through in a more indirect way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, I deal with my books tend to be very political, and it's not that I sat down and thought, okay, I want to write this political story. It's just that they are because I am.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say the same. I think I might be a little more conscious of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think I start out to write agitprop, but having come of age, you know, in the civil rights movement, the black arts movement, all of the work that people were doing was an expression of liberation and opening new worlds to us, the worlds of blackness. So I think I started writing in a very conscious way about blackness, the same as being a feminist. I started writing very consciously about women and how women are placed in the world. At the same time, I don't want to write a tract, you know,
of
so
course.
People will just, you know, snore. But I think though, having come of age in those particular movements make me much more conscious of it as I'm doing it. And I think that's one of the interesting things for this going from African Americans saying, how dare you write a vampire novel with African Americans in it? How could you do that? How could you connect those things? To, you know, 25 years later, as my vampire novel is about to have its 25th anniversary.
Wow.
And a new edition. To see the community come full circle and say, oh yeah, we're going to claim this and we're going to give it its own name, Afrofuturism. You know, it's really great. And in part, I think that's because the political evolution on campuses, in communities, poor communities who are starting to understand their economics has to be taken in their own hands.
Right.
They can't wait for the government to fix it. That racism, sexism, any of the isms really need to be in our hands. How we fight them need to be in our hands. And I think that is a sign of hope. And I think that's one of the reasons that our writing has started to spread out into these fields, into black comics, into future Afrofuturism, and other speculative fictions. I think it's a sign of hope.
You're listening to Afrofuturist authors on Making Contact. Nalo Hopkinson is the author of 9 books, from Brown Girl in the Ring to the Nebula Award-winning Sister Mine. Nnedi Okorafor writes African-based science fiction for both children and adults, including the Nebula and Hugo Award-winning Binti series and Akata Warrior. And Jewel Gomez is a writer, activist, and the author of the Double Lambda Award-winning novel, The Gilda Stories. Her dream play, Waiting for Giovanni, is about James Baldwin. For more information about these authors, visit the Making Contact website, radioproject.org, where you'll also find past episodes. You can sign up for news about upcoming shows, like us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter at @making_contact. You can also find us on Instagram at Making Contact Radio Project. Please rate us on iTunes. It helps other people find us. Now let's rejoin the conversation as our three authors discuss the monsters that have captured their imagination and what they hope to see in the future of Afrofuturism.
I'm sitting here trying to figure out why this monster is so central to so many of my stories. There are two. One of them is Godzilla. And this is why I'm sitting here trying to figure out, okay, because Godzilla has shown up in many of my stories in various ways. And I know that if someone were to just ask me without intellectualizing it, why do I like Godzilla, it's Godzilla's destructive nature. Godzilla comes out of the water and just destroys. There's no rhyme or reason. Just comes out, destroys everything, and then goes back into the water. I love that. And I don't know why. I don't know why. There's something about it. And it may have something to do with my obsession with post-apocalyptic narratives as well.
Okay.
This idea of everything being destroyed, you know, and then having to deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
It also may have to do with my anger issues. I don't know.
Get it somewhere. All right.
A lot of rage. The second monster, it's not really a monster. It's just this entity that has shown up consistently in my works now. It's in Lagoon, and it's in Akata Witch Part 2 as well. And it's this spider. It's this giant spider that is, its name is Udide, which means spider in Igbo. The first time the idea of the spider showed up in one of my stories, it was in my story called Spider the Artist, which deals with the Niger Delta, where you've got like these, it's set in the near future, where you have these, the government and the oil companies have created these robot spiders to guard the pipelines, the oil pipelines in Nigeria, can prevent people from bunkering. And these spiders, of course, they kill anyone who touches them. They just tear them to shreds so that they can guard the oil. So that's sort of another story. But this spider it's not a Nazi. I know that. I'm terrified of spiders. I don't know why. It's an irrational fear. And so spiders have always shown up in my stories, but this particular large one, it lives underneath the city of Lagos, and it turns onto its back and feels the vibrations of the people. And it's a monstrous spider, and it weaves and creates stories and narrative and controls everything. It's just... Yeah, so that's my second spider. Yeah, I'll stop there.
Okay, so I want to stop and read that story like right now.
Yeah.
What? Okay.
Well, I guess my monster started out as those two guys on the street, and has evolved to any figures that prey upon people who are less, powerful.
Right.
And I think that was one of the reasons I was interested in doing vampire stories, because Dracula is such a pervasive mythology, such a pervasive character, and insidious because he's charming and he's a serial killer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you go back to the original ones, that he, seduces women and kills them. And everybody is like excited. Dracula's coming over. You know, I'm like,
is it?
So that really fascinated me, that people would find this such a romantic figure in such a predatory figure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I remember one day I went with my mother and grandmother to see the play Dracula on Broadway. We left that and went to see the movie with Frank Langella, which was playing in Times Square
time.
And we were in conversation about that for hours. Like, how could he be so sexy and be such a killer?
Right.
That really set me up to work on how to redo the mythology so that I felt like vampire could be heroic and not a predator, not a serial killer. And in this new book that I'm working on, it's about the society becoming predatory, using people who are empathic, using people who have certain kinds of skills, artistic skills, and making them work for the government, segregating them into patches so they only associate with people who are doing what they do. And how to escape that. So the monster is really those who prey on less powerful people.
It is Stagoli, it is Papa Legba, it is Ishu. It is that tall, lean man, dark man in the top hat,
yes,
who knows more about the dark in you than you do, and knows that you want it.
Mm-hmm.
What I'd like to see, and what I think is going to, we're going to see more and more African writers from the continent.
That's right.
You know, writing Afrofuturist stories. And I think that the change that I've seen, because I've had a lot of interaction with especially Nigerian writers. And what I remember from maybe about 10 years ago, There was this general attitude of what is real literature, and science fiction and fantasy and speculative fiction were not considered real literature, and what was considered real literature were like Things Fall Apart, you know, serious writing without any of that weird stuff going on in it. But I think that we'll see more Africans directly from the continent writing this kind of literature, and I think that what they write is going to have like a different flavor as well. And what I also would like to see in terms of Afrofuturism is just more diversity in the types of writing. I'd like to see female writers, writers with disabilities, just more variety within Afrofuturist writing.
Right.
That's what I'm waiting to see, because right now it's so small. You know, and it's slowly building, and it's increasing and growing. But I'd like to see more of that, and I'd also like to see really an extremely successful Afrofuturist writer, extremely successful, as in like best-selling status,
yes. Yeah.
Who's mediocre.
Wow!
I want to see that. Yes.
Nice.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yes.
All right.
Okay. I want to see that.
For me, the idea that genre fiction, and I usually say speculative fiction to cover everything as an umbrella term, but I think speculative fiction is really an easy way for a large population to find themselves and find their politics. Mm. Any kind of genre fiction, whether it's detective stories, whether it's cartoons, whether it's a romance, I know you find that hard to believe, but any kind of genre fiction can get away with telling a political story. And if it's a genre fiction, more different kinds of people are going to read it because they feel like, oh, this is just going to be fun. And then when they finish, they realize, oh wow, I thought about that. That was deep. And whoa. And, you know, you saw Star Trek do it with issues around race. We see all kinds of TV speculative fiction shows introduce complex ideas. And I think the more of us who write and start writing younger, the more complex ideas we will put in genre fiction, and the more of us who will read them and become increasingly conscious of our political surroundings.
I hope it gives more people permission to know that they can imagine and that they can make stories. I mean, I think the three of us were at Astro Blackness, a few months ago, and there was a young woman in the audience, black woman, who also loved horror and didn't think she could write it because she kept imagining black characters until she found an ARC, an advanced reading copy of one of Octavia Butler's novels on the streetcar or whatever they do in LA. Mm. And then it was like her imagination broke open and now she's writing. And it cuts to my heart that somebody thinks that because they've never seen it, they can't do it. So that's where I would hope it's going, is that more of us have just sort of know that we can stand up and make what we imagine.
You've been listening to writers Nalo Hopkinson, Nnedi Okorafor, and Jewel Gomez.
And we're wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. And thanks to all of the contributors today, especially to Making Contact Radio. Feminist Magazine is produced by a coalition of feminist volunteers. You can find all the links from our program today on our website, feministmagazine.org. Find us on Facebook and on Instagram, or just email us at feministmagazine@yahoo.com. Our programs are archived in the kpfk.org audio archives. You can find our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play. Thanks for listening.
This is Jackson Brown, and you're listening to KPFK, the inspiration station, lifeline to the community, lifeline to the news and the information, the culture that sees us through the year after year. I'm asking you to take a moment and make a contribution to the station that keeps your world alive and in tune. The number to call is 818-985-5735. 818-985-KPFK. KPFK has been there my whole life. I don't really know how I would view the world without it.
Come on, cats, let's go, go, go.
Hi, I'm Bill Gardner, host of Rhapsody in Black. I play classic rhythm and blues from the 40s, 50s, and 60s. Boogie with Bill Gardner every Saturday afternoon from 2 to 4 on KPFK 90.7 FM.
Rock that boogie!
Please help keep independent journalism alive and KPFK Radio strong.